Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today I get to speak with someone that I'm familiar with through the Legacy 17 network that I'm part of. And it's like one of these people that you find in a Zoom room, because we've never really met in person. And there's just so much resonance whenever you shared ideas or perspectives. And so I got really curious. And here we are, more or less. Welcome to the podcast, Klaus Schenk.
Thank you, Amit. Yes, indeed. Zoom rooms seem to have surprising corners and lots of them.
And so what I'm really hoping to kind of circle and or at least use as a little bit of a gateway into a deeper discussion today is to talk about agile and agile development, actually, because I think that's fun, and that's a corner where you've spent a lot of time, it seems. So but before that, I want to start us off the way that I always do, with a very light, easy, simple question. Who are you, Klaus Schenk?
A light and easy question, looking for a brief answer. So who am I is really hard to answer. Currently, I am living happily in a mix of continuing to learn, following my own curiosity, and conversations with people like you, and conversations with people who find themselves in the role of clients. And when this is the case, this is about coaching, organizational development consulting, agility, and other places, and sometimes a tiny bit of therapy as well. Whether or not that tells who I am, I'm really not sure. This is more about what I do. Apart from that, I'm married for way beyond 30 years, and I have two adult sons, and I have two grandkids of 9 and 12 years old. And again, that's part of the context, and still not describing exactly who I am. I'm really a little bit lost here. Maybe I have a next question here.
Yeah, but thank you. And is this an open question, just to kind of get you to define as you wish? And one of the things, let's just move into the topic, because I'm very curious about the topic of agile development. I mean, it's been one of those frameworks that has been popularized over the last few years. And I've had a little bit of resistance to it. I've seen a lot. I see a lot of different people, and some of them I really resonate with, and some of them it seems very mechanistic and very sort of by the book and just follow the, here's the manual and there you go. And I'm curious about Agile. How did you come into it, and what is it to you, if we start in that end?
Yeah. I happened to stumble across a person talking about Agile in the flavor of Scrum around 2008. It was a guy from Germany who at that point in time worked as a freelance Scrum Master for the German Telekom, one of the large companies entering Agile pretty early, needing a lot of time applying that. And I got curious. He was attending a curriculum on solution-focused coaching in Munich, in southern Germany. And he, in his final presentation, he talked about Scrum. And I got curious, and I asked him about it, and I asked him, could I be an intern with you at any time? So I went to see him at the Telekom, and I went to see him at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland. And then I started reading. And at that time, he was one of the few people who were just about to organize the first Agile Coach Camp Germany, in the middle of Germany, next to Frankfurt. Lickersbach is the tiny place. And that was an exciting meeting. It was about 70 people meeting for 3 full days, all open space format. So there was no set program. And what really caught me and put me right in the middle of that community was this incredible spirit of people loving to share their knowledge to expand it collectively. And I have met a similar spirit only once before, 20 years ago, in the solution-focused community, solution-focused in organizations. So I really fell in love with that spirit. And I said, if you do it again, I'll be back. So I went to this Agile Coach Camp for the next 4 meetings and enjoyed every bit of that. That's how I came across Agile. And then a series of further meetings. It's pretty active community, the Agile, Scrum or otherwise. We'll come to those frameworks a little later. And there was retrospectives, facilitators, gatherings, Scrum user groups, and whatnot. So there is like one or two, there's the Play for Agile conference, so one or two larger conferences every year in Germany alone, and a lot of smaller activities. That's how I got there. And then I was a little bit confused about people having different understandings about Agile. So I just stayed in contact with the community, participated in the discussions, joined one company who offered an education for people who are already working. So it's not a study, a high school thing. It's a vocational education. And they had a long discussion at the Agile Coach Camp, how much knowledge or how much volume of educating do they think is useful and necessary? Because you can get a Scrum Master certificate with after a 2 days course or no course at all, just by filling out a multiple choice questionnaire, and that's it. And the idea was that's certainly not enough to be a competent Scrum Master afterwards. So what they came up with was a six-module, 2.5 days each curriculum. So pretty comprehensive. And I loved it. And I picked one module to teach it, and it improved my understanding. We had discussions with the other teaching staff and discussions with the people attending. And so over the years, I refined my understanding of Agile. And then 2 years, almost 3 years ago, came along a colleague of mine here, local buddy, Irmgard Barth, who had just finished, I don't know, basically every course you can ever do about Scrum and Kanban. He is certified back and forth all over the place with Jeff Schwaber and Ken Sutherland and all the big names. You know, she went everywhere. And she said, okay, now I learned it all. I'm applying it. I'm making good money. I would like to start teaching. And she wanted to do a Kanban course, and she needed some guinea pigs to develop the course. So I attended, and I really liked the way she explained Kanban. The original course has like 450 PowerPoint slides, and it really kills you. And she distilled that down to 30 flip charts, hand-painted, beautiful. And I really liked the way she did a comprehensive simulation game developed by a Belgian guy, Patrick Staird. And it tickled me. I really thought what I'm learning here about Kanban and about quantitative approaches to agility really fits my science background and is so different from stories I heard and people's behaviors I observed, which felt like folklore to me, or like, you know, agile cargo cult, as a colleague of mine calls that, where people believe just because we're doing a daily, now we're agile. And sorry, you aren't. A daily doesn't make you agile. So I got curious about what really is important, what can you not let go of when you talk about agile? And I started on a reading binge, which took the better of a year, and still is not quite finished here in my bookshelf. So now I would say I have made my peace with my own understanding of Agile, and I still like it. And I think it's very useful to apply Agile concepts and develop some kind of Agile attitude along the way. Yeah, brief question, long answer.
It's good ground to stand on. And so if we speak a little bit about what it is, apart from, well, maybe also including the tools that people might or might not be familiar with, but yeah. What is it?
I mean, the founding document still is the Agile Manifesto from 2001, and it's easy to find that on the web. And the Agile Manifesto was like a milestone along this development of agile concepts. And it, I mean, even the story, how it came about, it was written by 17 middle-aged white men in software industry in a place in the Rocky Mountains during in a ski resort or something. And this already tells that it is pretty selective in the view. At least 17 different people brings in some degree of diversity, but still it is heavily based on IT experience, and that's what it talks about in the beginning. At the same time, the concepts that are described there, the Agile Manifesto basically is two pages. So the first page is about a couple of values. What do we think is more important than other things? And the second page is about a couple of principles. And I like those principles. I like those ideas. My favorite, for example, is the idea of maximizing the amount of work not done, which is a funny way of saying focus on the important things and forget about the rest. At the same time, it does not in the document really acknowledge what is true, nevertheless, that it is, as somebody else has said, is standing on the shoulders of giants. It's a development that was based on ideas that other people have developed, and they merge in this document. And after the document, again, they diverge into many different streams. So it's like a focusing lens on a couple of developments that I started learning about. My first course, attending my first course in something that is called Total Quality Leadership, I took in 1992 when I had just started working in industry for an American pharmaceutical company. And that was based on the ideas of Edward Deming, who invented something called statistical process control, and with that helped Japanese engineers after World War II rebuilding their country and their industry. And basically, he was the person who, in collaboration with the chief engineer of Toyota, co-invented the Toyota production system and made Toyota the largest car manufacturer in the world. So there is quite some roots that Agile builds upon, and those ideas that Deming talked about, this theory of profound knowledge, as he called it, which is based on statistics, but at the same time teaches that if you don't have respect for people, forget about it. So this created two major pillars of the Toyota production system, and on these pillars, Agile also stands. And the one pillar is about the flow of work. It comes in different names. Some people call it just in time. Some people call it one piece flow. But however you call it, it's about how do you have to design your processes or your collaboration among people in such a way that each piece you work on flows smoothly through the whole working process with as little disruption as possible, and with the least interference with other people's, with other pieces of work that are in the process at the same time. So undisturbed, smooth flow of work through the system that tries to create value. And at the end, what you aspire to do is deliver value to customers, which means you need to involve customers in the whole process just to find out what is valuable to them. And how can you produce something that is valuable for customers with the least amount of waste? The one pillar is flow, and the other pillar is about respect for people. Nowadays, one of the critical points about Agile is that people in management misunderstand it as just another tool to squeeze out even more work out of people. And that is lacking respect for people. And I would say if it doesn't contain respect for people, it's not Agile. This is one of the founding values. So Toyota production system as well as Agile development, both are about flow of work to create customer value, respecting people who are doing the work. That would be my my current preliminary summary of what is Agile about.
I like that. That's interesting because I have not very rigorously, but been dabbling in, you know, like lean methodology and in some of those, like the type of, you know, cleaning and sorting systems of like 5S as a precursor of going towards lean and so forth. And there is there's also this principle of, I don't know what the source is, but somebody speaks of like how over-formalization is a real big threat towards like against culture and against like it makes things into rigid pieces that shouldn't necessarily be rigid. There's you have to have a very fine-tuned sense for what should be sort of formalized and what should be extracted or like reduced, if you will.
Yes. So, you could say simplification is a high value, both in agile development as well as in Toyota production system. And it was already formulated in the Toyota times. They had a combination of six, or later it was eight types of waste that you should try to reduce in system. And overcomplication was one of them. Overburden was one of them. And there's a couple of others. And Toyota production system has been published already in 1978 in a book by Taichi Ono, the chief engineer of Toyota. And it took another 12 years before the first Americans, Womack and Roos, wrote that book about lean, what they then called lean, and nowadays all known under lean.
So if we keep sort of walking the path here, we have the two sort of founding pillars. Mm. And so the experience that I've had is more on that end where the respect for people is missing. That's where I would tend to see most of the implementation, so to say. It becomes kind of empty tools, and there's not a strong connection to why we are doing this particular thing. And it's not really in service of the people; it's rather in service of something, or just in doing the thing. It's like it becomes a thing in itself. So I don't know if you would want to speak to that piece, like how would you go about? How do you? How would you enshrine or like prioritize this respect for people? Like how do you put that at the forefront and get this dynamism between the flow and the value and and the system and the people? Like how do you put that in conversation?
Another one that's not really easy to answer. I would say probably that respect for people is the foundation for everything else. It's if you want to create a value-creating flow system, a company that produces something, a part of a company that develops something that is of use for somebody else. Now, if you want to create a system that creates value for others, you first have to value the people who are supposed to do the work, and that is respect for people. Value difference, value that you need different competences, different attitudes, a variety of different people to create anything of value. So in my worldview, respect, I don't know, really to be curious about the worlds of other people. And what do they bring, and how could that be combined with other people's talents and competences and skills and experience to do something that none of us could do alone? And then finding good ways of putting that into interaction with people who are on the receiving end of what you try to produce. And starting a conversation with those people already during development. What is it that you really need? Usually customers or as nowadays the software people tend to say, users, which always sounds like drug users to me, users, customers, what is it that you really want? And when you ask them, usually they don't know, and you don't know either. So you already have to start with conversations that are creative, and conversations are only creative if you treat people well. So again, we are at respecting difference and putting difference to work by constructive conversations. And then you start to find out what's possible and feasible on the technological side and on the production side. And you find out what is appreciated, valued, and ultimately also being paid for on the customer side. And the way you lead those conversations co-determines how much value you can create by the conversation and the experiments that are accompanied by conversations, ongoing conversations. Oh.
And that's nice, but so the thing, what I'm getting a hold of, what like my resistance, if I would look at sort of the resistance towards it, is it has to do with the quantification, I think, of this different things, because it's, to me, it's like value is almost like a qualitative value, and it, you know, it's a qualitative feeling. It's not necessarily more. It's there are so many pieces to value that is not encapsulated by, let's say, more profit or higher yield or like whatever it might be that we could. And so when we translate that value into different things that we are then quantifying, and then also that we're then determining these, like the pacing and like how we move things through the system and so forth, that translation seems to be incredibly important in order to allow for this. And I don't know, how do you think about that aspect?
I think I agree. Value is something that is by some people only measured in quantitative terms, like in dollars. By engineers, it's measured in measurable metrics like lack of variance. You know, if you can produce the same thing over and over and over again to the absolutely same specification, that is called quality. And the engineers then hope that customers do value that, whereas customers usually do not love to be standardized, except in times of extreme lack of something. You know, when you look back at Henry Ford, when he started this mass production, he could still afford to say you can have any color you like in your car as long as it's black, because that helped him standardize, which helped him produce the same thing in large amounts, and he had enough customers to buy his Model T car in black, because everybody loved the idea of the new options of mobility. Nowadays, imagine one car dealer telling you the same story: you can have any color you like as long as it's black. People would run away. So the concept of what do people value varies over time. And there's so many influences. It values under political systems. It values especially, I mean, recently with the advent of Agile, I think what has changed is that people realized that they needed all the intelligence they could get to be able to keep up with the pace of software development. So they really needed to appreciate people who wanted to contribute. So this is valuing diversity, and that's hard to measure. Of course, you can quantify variance by statistical terms. That's exactly what Deming did. There's a nice book by Donald Hubbard, I think, or Hubbard, How to Measure Anything. So with statistical methods, you can quantify a lot. But still, you know, if you go totally on the human side, how would you quantify love? Everybody values love, especially being loved or loving somebody. How would you quantify that? By the amount of emojis in your text messages? Probably not. Some people might. I don't know. So there's a spectrum, and quantitative measures are on the one end, and totally qualitative, individual understandings of what do I value on the other hand.
But what's the room for? Because that's what I have the in my head. I have the sort of the Kanban boards, and then you have your sprints, and then you would sort of progress things through the boards, and you know you get a pace, and you get a certain level of, you know, tasks completed, and then you have all of these ideas of like Little's Law that you don't want to overstuff the pipeline, because then the pace of work goes down, and there's so much. As a very sort of a rookie, you know, as an outsider, if you will, but that has just kind of dipped a toe in, it looks like there's a lot of things that's focusing on almost like it's a very reductionist logic in a way. And then it's like speed over a lot of other things. It feels natural that you have lean, like you have the agile, you know, that type of methodology, and then you have this Silicon Valley type culture of like, let's move fast and break things. Like, it's fine, you know. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Or like, what am I missing?
Maybe to try and cluster a little bit of that overboarding diversity that this agile field has developed into. Two of the best known frameworks probably are Scrum and Kanban. And a third one that has gained some popularity is something called DevOps. And my understanding, my current state of misunderstanding, you might call, is that Scrum had the advantage of being very easy to teach. You have these three roles and five artifacts and three something and that, and you can really nicely memorize that. So it's easy to teach, and that's an evolutionary advantage if a method is supposed to spread. When it's easy to teach, it gains more virulence in spreading. Kanban already started with Toyota, and Kanban is more about uninterrupted flow and reducing waste. So in some way, you could say Kanban is closer to control, to quantification, to reduction of waste, and to standardization, more inclined to. Whereas Scrum focuses more prominently on the cross-functional team. So if you will, Kanban has more the flow focus and Scrum has more the people focus. And that's why, especially in Scrum, the people who like Scrum sometimes have a degree of adversity towards influence from the outside of the team. So management is stylized as the natural enemy of self-organization in a cross-functional team, because the team is the holy thing. Whereas in Kanban, the team may change as long as the workflow, you know, one of the basic ideas of Kanban is focus on flow and let people self-organize around the flow, which is different from focus on the team and then portion the work into small bits and pieces so that the team is maximally efficient. So this is not a true distinction between Scrum is only that and Kanban is only that, but there is an accent of Scrum more on the team side and Kanban more on the flow side. Another distinction is the one between production and development. If you want to produce something in reliable quality, standardization might be a good idea. If you have large numbers and want to reproduce the same thing over and over, your life is more easy if you standardize. And if you simplify production processes, you cut out the waste, you increase flow efficiency, and you get the same thing out in the needed quantity. So production is more on standardization, whereas development wants to create something new. So development by default is about creating difference, is about creating variation, is about innovation, is about everything but standardization. So there's again a natural tension between development needing variation and production being more inclined to repetition and standardization. And DevOps in software is trying to bridge the two and to help the developers already understand the needs of the production team to make their life easier. One of the ways you could describe agile approaches is like in improvisation theater. Improv theater has, I once learned from a colleague from Tasmania who said, you just have to follow three rules. Know what's happening, which in agile means know what the customer might value. Yeah. Collaborate to improve what's happening. This is developing something new, improve, constant improvement process. And number three is make life easier for the next in line. You know, do not produce something that makes your life easy but troubles the next one. Do not produce machinery that is impossible to maintain afterwards. So have the people downstream already in the conversation and optimize something along the whole value chain, which starts with the customer idea. Then you try to develop ideas, you develop products or software. You put it in production, you deliver it to the customer, they use it, they love it, they have comments, and you try to improve further. The whole thing is a value chain, and whatever you do in agile or otherwise should improve the whole value chain. Mm. So in development, the advantage of a Scrum team is you have all the competences in one place, and people, especially if they are co-located, they can have discussions all day long while continuing to develop something. In Kanban, you have more of the focus on the speed of development. And as in turbulent times or in the VUCA world, as the buzzword goes, you know, this volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous world, things change all the time. So it's a competitive advantage to be fast enough to keep up. So speed becomes valued by many people. And how do you speed up the thinking in people? Usually by putting them in one place and having diversity there, and then enabling dialogues and enabling prototyping, getting results, discussing the results, you know, creating feedback loops on feedback loops, and that speeds things up. While there's a limit, and you mentioned that, Little's Law says that you can speed up things only so far. And if you try to push more work into a system than the system's capacity at its bottleneck is, then you create not flow, but traffic jam. So somewhere between focus on people, Scrum team, focus on flow, Kanban, expanding your view across the whole value stream, development to production, to delivery, to maintenance, and respecting those mathematical limits to flow, my capacity. This is the set of ingredients you should take care of when you try to build a functioning system trying to produce value. And listening to myself, I'm not sure how understandable that is to somebody who, like you, says, well, I'm a rookie in that area.
But it definitely speaks to my, because here, what I'm hearing that enters in here is sort of the systemic view of yes. things. And there seems to be, what I'm hearing is that there is unless we have a strong connection to the whole, then taking a look at the individual parts doesn't really make much sense. And quantifying the individual parts doesn't make much sense. And it's really interesting. I read somebody who was being very kind to Descartes because he's getting so much shit in general for having put us in this calamity where we are with this split. But somebody was saying that in his worldview, given his beliefs, religious beliefs, and so forth, it was inconceivable for him that you would take this method of sort of, what do you call it, like deconstruction that this method that he designed, which is so incredibly powerful, and just rip it out of context of this whole, which was also there. So that's also what I'm hearing you, in a way, invoking in this discussion.
Yeah, and again, I think there is value in both sides of this, you could say, this field of tension between two poles, which I like to call a polarity. A polarity is the poles of opposition, like day and night, black and white, etc., and all the different mixtures in between. You know, between day and night, you have dusk and dawn, and it's getting brighter and brighter, and then you have daylight, and then it's getting darker and darker. And these polarities also could be constructed between, like, analysis and synthesis.
Mm.
You have Descartes, who says, well, okay, you can distinguish between thinking and the things. And you had Frederick Taylor, who just split that into hairs. So everybody without any thinking could do some repetitive work, and other people had the task of reconfiguring those parts into some useful whole. In Agile, and even more so in something called the theory of constraints, which I would count under one of those Agile, it could be counted under one of those Agile methods. Not everybody knows about this idea. Developed by an Israeli physicist by the name of Eli Goldratt, he clearly claimed that the biggest mistake you can do is try to optimize locally, to take a part and try to perfectionate this part, because, as he said, local optimization necessarily leads to global sub-optimization.
Mm.
So if you want to have a precious whole, a precious, like a complete package of software or a good team, whenever any person in the team wants to be the star, the team suffers. Optimizing one person goes at the cost of the team. You can see that in soccer games, where those all-star teams usually lose to teams without a star, but with a better interaction. So the idea, the system's idea of parts and wholes says, take good care of both the parts and the whole, and do not try to optimize one at the cost of the other. And if you have to optimize anything at the cost of the other, rather optimize the whole. In simpler words, that means don't try to get the biggest piece of the cake, rather collaborate to make the whole cake bigger in the first place. So everybody gets a bigger piece of the cake. If everybody's just grabbing the pieces, the cake is too small. So collaborate to optimize the whole, the global optimum, and then forget about the local optimization. You don't need it anymore.
And then, I mean, that there are two parallel things that come alive in me. But one thing is then, how do we define the whole? You know, because it's like, is it the company? Is it the society? Is it the world? Is it the team? Is it the, you know, whatever it might be? That all of a sudden becomes extremely important. And then I like this idea also of putting these different ideas into conversation with one another. I mean, that's really nice, because you can, we don't leave anything off of the table. It's rather we can pick it up and take a look at it and see whether it seems to make sense and whether it feels useful, and then we can kind of, we have to dance with it. I mean, we have to adapt it. We have to be, that's where the creativity lies in a way.
Mm-hmm.
The other point that came alive was this idea of resilience, or I mean, there's this sort of biological principle around redundancy in ecosystems, that there is always redundancy. There's always that. And then one of the critiques that I hear sometimes about the technological sphere, the industrial sphere, is that we, in our just in time, we are building very sort of drawn out, brittle, sensitive supply chains, which we saw during the pandemic and so forth, that they start breaking, and then if one node breaks, then there's such a concentration to that node that it ripples through the system.
Hmm.
How does that idea of resiliency come into how you work with organizations?
That's at least three questions that I heard here. Let me try and see if I remember them. The first one was about, is the team, the department, the organization, or the market, or the whole world, the system.
And yeah, it's like, how do we, clearly, yeah.
The answer clearly is yes. All of those are. It's nested systems, you know, it's like those Russian dolls. This is something that it's a system is more like a pattern that repeats across scales of magnitude. 15 years ago, I had my own description. I call that CoreFu, which stands for the core fractal unit of viable systems. I was looking for the smallest unit you could describe, and basically it has like two previously independent actors that get into an interaction, that exchange something, you know, conversation, you talk, I talk, you talk, I listen, or creation, I create something, you pay for it, etc. They have an interaction. And whenever that is more than a one-time interaction, that co-creates, from this interaction emerges a next larger system. And then the pattern repeats. So much for the system part. Then for this aspect of resilience, that's interesting. I read, when I first started reading about systems, I was still in schools, and this limits to growth thing had just come out, the book which was published in 1972. And I read that sometime around 76 or so in my father's bookshelf. And a little later, I came across a proponent of those ideas from the MIT, on which the Club of Rome had built their simulations that ended up as the Limits to Growth report. And the German proponent for that approach is a guy by the name of Frederick Fester. And he wrote a book about systems where he described the surprising observation of a species of butterflies in England. They are the birch butterflies, they are called, because they feed on birch trees, and their coloring is mostly white with a few black spots on them. And he said, strange enough, 5% of those butterflies routinely were reverse color, mainly black with some white spots. How do you explain that? Evolution would claim they would have to become extinct long ago. He said, still the species reproduces this kind of variation. Along comes the Industrial Revolution in England, and suddenly everybody's burning coal, no filters in the chimneys, so suddenly all the birches start becoming more black than white. Now suddenly it's a big advantage to be more black than white. Now the whole species of butterflies switches over to the other pattern. Suddenly there's much more butterflies, more black than white, but around 5% are stubborn and keep the more white than black. So what I took from that is this surprising wisdom in the system to somehow be prepared for disruptive change. Catastrophes have run around the world long before a climate crisis, the current one, and only those species who had enough resilience somewhere in the system survived long enough to procreate children, progeny. So resilience is a necessary condition to survive under evolutionary instability. And lack of resilience is a luxury we can only afford as long as circumstances stay stable. Whenever they change, we need to change too, and we need to have that flexibility in our repertoire before we change, else it might be too late.
And how does it then become a variable, let's say, in the quote unquote, like the global optimization equation that we're working with? Or how do we, because it's, I mean, there's that, you know, there's that aspect of value and you know, value now versus value later. I mean, time becomes important all of a sudden, and it's tricky.
Yeah, again, it's tricky at several aspects. One of them that comes to mind when I listen to your question is about the question, what does global optimization mean on a global, whole Earth scale? Here, I think we currently experience the risk of that we, the human species, could be regarded by the rest of the globe as one part running wild and needing to be eliminated for the sake of the globe. It's a pretty dire view, you could say. But sometimes, as I did work in cancer research 25 years ago, sometimes it seems so obvious that what happens in the body when cancer cells decline to integrate into the coordination and regulation of the whole organism. So they run their own show, which leads to the death of the organism. And humans as a species do something structurally similar, something, again, fractally similar to the planet. We are running our own show. We ignore our ecological interdependence with the rest of the ecosystem and the globe. And by that, we behave like cancer cells killing their host. And the host, the Earth, can well live without us humans. So the Earth can afford getting rid of what disturbs, but not the other way around. So if we want to stay a vital part of the whole ecosystem, we should start taking care of our interdependence with the ecosystem more than we did so far. And in a way, you mentioned the context where we met, Legacy 17. This is about sustainable development and those SDGs of the United Nations. And when you start measuring how much are those SDGs lived, you see a wide gap between what is needed and what is already achieved.
But that's kind of the that's the challenge that I'm sitting with as well. It's like you. When there are so many, the SDGs alone, there's 17 of them, right? And if we are supposed to measure and follow up and set goals and so forth against all of these, then it becomes very tricky. And then I see the current approach is like, oh, so we focus on these two, And then speaking of like local optimizations, then we're in tricky territory again, because we are, at the expense of what? Like, what do we, when we look at certain things, it's like this, the Zen story of the the man looking for his keys under the light bulb.
Yes.
It's like, do you think you dropped your keys here? No, but this is where I can see it. And then of course, like there's the other swing of that pendulum, which is like, oh, nothing can be measured. Let's just, we're all sense organs. Let's just sense our way using our gut feeling. Or if Ian McGilchrist, in his language, it would be sort of the right brain. Let's just look at the whole. That's all we should focus on. And yet at the same time, I very much share the sentiment that I'm getting from you is to put these in conversation with one another, to be, radically aware of the whole and to hold that, but then measure and move with what we can, and then also do that in a way that is pragmatic. I spoke to someone else that talked about the pragmatic edge, which I really liked. Yeah. To stay on the pragmatic edge of something.
Listening to that brings two people, two names, and two concepts, related concepts, to mind. One is this idea by Kate Raworth, a British economist, about the donut economics, where she said, what we need to respect is that we only have some kind of corridor or some, she says, an area where vital and just life is possible. And it has two boundaries. The outside boundary is the boundary set by ecology. How much can the planet or the ecology stand? And losing biodiversity and ruining the climate and using the oceans as a dump is is breaking this ecological ceiling. Yeah. And the other boundary is that of human values again, is that of respect for people. And when large amounts of people live in poverty, hunger, and war, this is breaking the human boundary. And in between the two is a corridor of just life.
Yeah.
And I like that. She paints it as two circles, you know, and that's why one of her listeners once proposed this term, looks like a donut. Now she's speaking of the donut economics. And there's an interesting website called Deal Donut Economics Action Lab, where this is put into action pragmatically, you know.
Yeah.
And with those boundaries, the other person and name that comes to mind is Dave Snowden, who developed this concept about the difference between complicated and complex. And he calls his model Kinevin framework. Kinevin is a Welsh word, he explains, and it stands for the habitat, the place of all our belongings, which is pretty closely related to the concept of ecology, you know, all those belongings. And he says when things are complicated, you can use cause and effect to analyze and to optimize, and expertise is useful. But when things are complex, there is not that straightforward connection between cause and effect. It's more try things out and then go from there. It's more about emergence. He has this lovely metaphor, you find that at YouTube, about how do you manage a party of 9-year-olds. And he says, if you believe it is complicated, you bring in the elder people and you have motivational posters all over the place, you know, and all that usual management bohau. If you accept that it's complex, you operate in a different way. You start by drawing a line in the sand and tell them, cross that line, you little bastards, and you die. which is a bit drastic, but the idea is that to handle a complex system, you have to set boundaries and then put in some stimulus within those boundaries, you know, like probes. He calls those catalytic probes. The party, it might be a video game or a football or something, you know, and from then you modulate behavior. You dampen what you dislike, which is not good for the whole. And you stimulate what is good for them. So that's a very different behavior. And I see that create a boundary around your system in Kate Raworth's donut economics. She has two boundaries in her system. And in between, we can modulate our behavior. And whenever we stop modulating it, whenever we are overshooting the boundaries, we are shooting our own foot. You know, we are killing ourselves by disrespecting the limits, the boundaries of what is clearly a complex system.
I like that. That's nice, because that would also be able to kind of translate into the what we were speaking about earlier with the team or with the flow in the entire company or like whatever you are. There is a boundary that you would be drawing and then you would be modulating. And it's not about sort of extinguishing or only promoting or banning, but it's rather it's modulation. It's an invitation to.
Absolutely.
You know, and then you still have, maybe you have those 5% of variance of the butterflies in the end, where you would, you know, when something unexpected happens, those would become a more competitive.
Absolutely. And you see those improv theater rules that I mentioned before. Know what's happening, collaborate to improve, and make it easier for the next person. The same approach is found in solution-focused approaches to organizations. Here, the rule is learn to distinguish what works and what doesn't, which is about what is your criterion for what should be amplified and what should be dampened. You know, it goes back to the values. What works? How do you define what works for you in a system? Once you made that distinction, learn to distinguish what works from what doesn't, then two rules apply. Number one, do more of what works. That is a different way of saying amplify what's good for the system. And if it doesn't work, the other rule says, if it doesn't work, stop doing it and experiment until you find something that works. And then go back to rule number one. And that's a nice way of navigating under emergent conditions. And that's basically the same idea as all those agile approaches. It's try and error. And then finding what works by try and error, and then consolidating what works into processes for a continuous learning process or continuous improvement process, if you will. But it's more about learning than improving. Consolidating that, and then until it doesn't work anymore, and then go back to experimenting, finding something that works again. So improvisation in theater, solution-focused approaches to organization, and agile is all about the ecology of approaches in complex systems.
Yeah. I like that. And then if we go back to that fundamental pillar of the lean, which is respect for people, then once we put that in conversation with, because that would also translate into maybe, I would use almost the language of caring about relationships, and there's something which I've, when it comes to the raw worth, like the donut economics, it's like, and I think Tyson Yunkaporta said that he's an indigenous Aboriginal person, and he says instead of growth, they're talking about increase. They celebrate increase. Mm-hmm. And increase would almost be, I've always seen it as this, in this donut that we are seeing, we could have we can make it denser. There's room between the nodes, and we can make it denser by increasing our relationality. Mm-hmm. So if we can relate to more nodes in this, then the donut will get denser, and we will have increase. It's not growth. It's not expanding outwards. It's more expanding downwards. Or it's like getting denser. And I'm wondering about sort of the. I had a point there, which I was heading towards, and now I kind of lost it. But maybe it seems like what you're speaking about, this ecology of practices are, it's the same point I think that I've tried to allude at before, but it's in relationship to something which is worth doing. That's like there's a there's always that and sometimes I feel like that's lost. Like that's it should be worth doing. Like we sometimes this experimental, the trial and error is, it's a good in itself. As long as we are trying and making errors, it's good, And I'm like,
what I hear here is number one, experimentation, a spirit and an attitude of willingness to experiment is a good idea, as long as you make sure that you survive the experiment.
Yeah, exactly.
This idea of safe scale experiment. And some people from that community of James Lovelock saying the earth is like a whole organism, people like him say mankind is earth experiment to find out whether a large forebrain and opposable thumbs are a good idea. Opposable thumbs allow us to create tools that other species can't, and a large forebrain allows us to think in a more rational way, and by that co-create our own destruction. And then maybe it's not a good idea to run that experiment for too long. But apart from the global scale, a spirit of experimentation is a good idea, but please make sure it's safe to fail. It's survivable. Experiment. And there was something else in that point which I'm missing now, but it may come back.
it comes back to, I think, something that came alive before, but that is that the value, as we're speaking of it. Yeah. And at the moment, I'm really wondering about our relationship to value, like how healthy are the things that we value.
Yes.
And I spoke to somebody. Yeah, please.
And you mentioned that it's not about growth. And it might be about increasing density. But then again, both terms remind me of a quote by Gregory Bateson, one of those founding fathers, you might say, of ecological thinking. when he speaks about a role, he says a role in an organization or in an ecosystem, a role is just a half-assed relationship. A role is something like one of the two poles of a polarity. But the relationship between the poles is the important thing. He's claimed somewhere even that the world does not consist of elements, not of atoms or, you know, planets. The world consists of relationships. And relationships is that thing that is hard to locate because it's something happening in between two points, two poles. And when we talk about growth without the opposite, it's just a half-assed relationship and it cannot work. So, and the same might be true for increasing density. Maybe we need increasing density at some point and then we need decreasing density at another point. So maybe it's more of a circular movement rather than a linear in any direction. And I think the same is true in music, where I know that you have a relationship to, you know. If you crowded the whole space with notes on the sheet where you notate the music and increase the density, what you create is noise, not music. So the pauses between the notes are as important as the notes. And you cannot optimize or maximize one at the cost of the other.
Yeah, I agree. That resonates strongly. And I think the relational, so the density that I'm longing to increase is the number of relations rather than the actual things.
And with the number of relations, you co-create, if you want it or not, complexity. And then again, we have to change patterns to handle increasing complexity without complexity running amok. And maybe that's where this idea of respect for people, or in a wider sense, even respect for life, needs to include the end of life as well. You know, we somehow it needs to include respect for finitude.
I think that's one of the main, for me at least, is one of the main the biggest question marks of corporations has been I'm just reading Jeremy Lent's book Web of Meaning, and in towards the end there he has a pretty strong opposition, let's say, against the corporation, the limited liability company, and what it has done and what it is doing to our planet and so forth. And there is the part where I think, which I think is the most probably serious with regards to that, is that the going concern, that it doesn't die. It just keeps keeps going and molding, but it doesn't die. There's no function for it to really die. And well, there is a function for it, but it's it's a tricky one.
Yeah. And there is a function for it, you know. Here, I mean, this, I certainly disagree in many respects with neoliberal ideas of pure market and leave everything to the market, while at the same time, at least for most corporations, the market has a regulatory function and companies die out. The average time in any of those, like Dow Jones indexes, is being ever reduced. Currently, I think Dow Jones has a company in the Dow Jones has a lifespan below 12 years. So companies do die out. The question is this aligned with the needs of the larger system? Maybe they die out too late. So they accumulate too much damage before dying out, and they are limited. They have limited liability to the damage they create, which means they outsource the damage to the society, which is a stupid idea from the society to allow that. So some kind of fundamental error in the construction of our economic system seems to shine through here. Like this idea of interest growing on interest, you know. Any kind of ever-growing or exponentially growing system within a finite system is doomed to fail. in a fundamental way, and we just try to ignore it, and then we might become the ones to being doomed to fail and become extinct.
And in a nice way, that kind of circles back to this idea of the values. Like, what are the values that we value? Like, and whose values are that? And are they taught? I know that this whole idea of the sort of the collective imaginary, or like these stories that we tell ourselves that our world is based upon, like that the economic system has to grow, but the economic system has to grow for itself. That's a very different story than you know, we need oxygen in the atmosphere. I mean, the oxygen in the atmosphere is actually, that's going to be a very tangible effect if that goes away. If all of us decided tomorrow that we're not going to grow anymore, that's going to be a very different type of result. It might be, you know, it's complex, and I don't know what the end point is going to be. And it might anyways result in death of everybody because of reasons, but it's a story. You know, and that's, it's against that story that we are spinning another story of value. And in that story of value, we're spinning, and then it cascades in some way. And so.
Hmm. Yeah. And it links back to this idea of local or global optimization. Whenever you use one pole, you know, one of those half-assed parts of a relationship, whenever you use one part and set that absolute, like economics has done with growth, and said, growth is the holy grail we're all going for, then you're doomed to fail, because you start to disrespect the rest of life, and you start to try to live at the cost of the rest of life, and the rest of life will not accept that. It will backfire. And listening to myself here, it sounds like I was pessimistic. I'm not pessimistic very much. I'm a little bit scared by what I hear about extrapolation of current developments. And I'm trying to better understand how can you explain that, to find the points, you know, the sensitive points where things could still be changed. And this idea within complex systems that you have those butterfly effects, and you can find sensitive points, and with minimum impact, with minimum input, you create maximum reaction of the system. I'd love to understand that better, to find some point of influence where you can turn around the current development. But as long as we believe we are independent of the rest of the system, we will be taught by the rest of the system that this is not how things work.
Maybe that's a good pause point, but I really appreciate that. I appreciate that you're also involved in the search for those points of where we could perhaps attract or leverage or work with. And I'm also very encouraged by this whole, because what you're speaking to as well is like, let's not talk so much about direct action or first order effects. Let's see how things propagate through the system rather. And there's a big level of trust that's needed there. Maybe we're already doing enough, and we can always do more. Hmm. And I have a big interest in my kids getting to grow up in the least painful world that they could possibly grow up in. But that's internal resilience, and it's external resilience, and there's a lot of components to it, as you were saying. There's nothing one-sided or half-assed about it.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to say at this point before we close?
Well, the one thing that still resonates with me is our returning again and again to that question of values. And I think that might be a question for a different conversation. But for today, just I'd like to briefly point towards, you know, ways of looking at the world. For example, Ken Wilber's way of integral philosophy, or Beck and Cowan's, what's it called, spiral dynamics, where they say what we value is dependent on our state of development. And there is a development of values that swings back and forth between valuing the individual, the part, and then valuing the collective, the whole. and swinging back and forth. And just to keep that idea in mind, that values, what we value, what we respect, what we care for, again, is not independent of the context that is relevant for us. And we learn from the culture we grow up in, and interacting with the culture, we may attempt to change it and we may fail or we may not fail. So again, culture is yet another complex system which influences what we value. And in that mix of reflecting about what is important, what do we value, and then going back to action, trying to influence what happens to protect those values, to live those values. And in that swinging back and forth between reflection and action, probably that's where a developmental path might emerge that is useful. At least that's what I would hope for from my current state of value system.
Thank you. And if people want to find you, interact with you, why should they find you and interact with you? And where can they find you and interact with you if they want?
Well, they can Google me. I have a sticky website that started off as an experiment on a Google site. So it has a strange address that probably should be given in writing. And I'll send you the name of the Google page.
It'll be in the show notes. Yeah.
And there's a couple of reading materials that can be freely downloaded to get a better understanding of potential answers to your first question, who am I? Probably I am the many, the many faces. And why should they find me? Well, if they are curious and love to enter a conversation about these or related topics, I would be happy to be part of those conversations and continue those, like I was happy today to be part of this conversation with you.
Thank you very much, Klaus. I really appreciate you taking the time. This is wonderful.
Thank you, Amit. I really loved the way you ask short questions and kicking off lengthy answers and bringing the patience to listen to those. Thank you very much.